everyone. Welcome to Title Now, which is a series of monthly pop-up webinars that the fund puts on various topics of interest to the real estate industry. I'm Melissa Murphy, and I have the pleasure of hosting these pop-up webinars. I really do enjoy them. They're a lot of fun to put together. They're a lot of fun to participate in. And what's even more fun is to hear your reaction to them. So keep those cards and letters coming. A reminder that we do push the audio out on our podcast, which is also conveniently called Title Now. It's free. You can get it wherever you get your podcast. You can subscribe to it. So I would love for you to do that because it's a great way for us to get this content out to more people because it's really easy to share that information through the podcast with your colleagues and your friends who might also be interested in whatever we're talking about today. So to that end, let's get to what we're talking about today. Because everyone is talking about the settlement agreement entered into earlier this year by the National Association of Realtors. And of course, this was in connection with a series of lawsuits that had been filed in various parts of the country in which NAR was allegedly doing something very wrong in the way in which brokers cooperated in commissions through the multiple listing service, or of course, we all call that the MLS. Now, the dust is not settled by any means on what impact this is going to have on the industry. And some people question whether it's going to have any real impact at all. And people are definitely prone to opining on what they think is going to happen, on prognosticating about the future of real estate agents. So I thought it was time to have a conversation about the situation, even though there are so many issues that have not yet been resolved. But that's kind of what we're here to talk about today. And I have two guests with me today that are very involved in this issue. David Searle, who is broker owner of RE/MAX Services in Boca Raton and president of the Broward, Palm Beach, and St. Lucie Realtors Association. And I think you represent around 43,000 realtors. Do I have that number right?
Correct. Yes.
Close enough. And then Evian White DeLeon, who is the chief legal counsel for the Miami Association of Realtors. I think she has you beat there a little bit, maybe 60,000 realtors in your
association. That's right.
So welcome, Evian and David. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Sure. Housekeeping, post your questions in the question area of the panel that's on the right-hand side of your screen. And I have the multi-talented Jay St. Lawrence behind the scenes monitoring those questions. And I will ask Jay to offer up a couple of questions at the end of the podcast. And if we don't get to your question, I promise you, I will respond directly to you afterwards. So I thought we would start with kind of level setting on the status of the litigation. And this is going to be at a high level, but if either you, David, or Evian have maybe a slight clarification or correction to what I say, please jump in. But there was a settlement agreement reached, and the court granted preliminary approval of that settlement around April 23rd. Final approval is scheduled at a hearing on November 26th. But NAR, a National Association of Realtors, is doing some things now to implement and carry through on what was agreed to in the settlement because it is slated to take effect in mid-August. And I think August 17th is the actual date. So even though final court approval is not until November, things are going to start changing and are required to change by the middle of August. And I'm seeing two major changes or two primary changes that are emphasized in what I've been reading coming out of this settlement. And David and Evian, you might see others that you think are worth mentioning, but the two that I have focused on is first, prohibiting offers of compensation on the MLS. What does that mean? No agreement for a cooperative sharing of commissions between listing and selling realtors can be shown on the MLS. There is still the opportunity for consumers, meaning buyers, to negotiate that with the seller, but it can't show up on the MLS. And then, excuse me, and then the second big piece is requiring MLS participants working with buyers, which is something that I want to talk about. What the heck does that mean? Working with buyers to enter into written agreements before they can show a home. So let's start with that latter piece, which is the buyer representation agreements. So what are the provisions that NAR, the settlement with NAR requires be in those broker representation agreements? Do either one of you have information on that?
So I'll jump in and David, tag along on anything that you know you want to add, but here's the high level changes with regard to the buyer broker agreements. When we talk about showing a home, right? The settlement agreement that NAR negotiated and inked says that you have to have a buyer rep agreement as working with a buyer before showing. What does showing mean? Does it mean emailing somebody a listing? Absolutely not. It means touring a home, right? So I want to be really careful about that language. I know that's the language in the settlement agreement, but really it's about touring a home, right? And the MLSs, the realtor associations, we are providing our members with the various tools on what those buyer broker agreements can look like. The model templates, or the templates, not really models, but the forms that are coming down from Florida realtors are expected before August 17th as well, so that they're ready for that that timeline. But that's not the only form a buyer broker agreement can take, right? There are many, many different forms that a buyer broker agreement can take. We're already seeing them in the market. That, like every other decision in brokerages, has to be made unilaterally and independently to comply with, one, our antitrust policy, and two, antitrust laws, big picture. So again, showing a home means touring a home. So before you're working with a buyer, you step foot into a home to tour it, whether that's virtually, your virtual feet or your real feet, you have to have a buyer broker agreement signed. And within the buyer broker agreement, so Melissa, you talked about the two high level changes, right? Comp coming off MLS and the buyer broker agreements. The third big change that I like to talk about that sort of is a blanket over both of those are the compensation disclosures that are going to be required. And those are embedded in the buyer broker agreement.
Yeah. And thank you, Evian. You know, one of the things that we're looking at is, you know, there's different business models centered around buyer brokerage agreements, and they're centered around written agreements, right? The requirement is a written agreement. So you could have a showing agreement, a commission agreement, a buyer brokerage agreement, whatever that may look like. Some of the business practices that we've been implementing in our office and some of the other offices are, you know, we call it the date and the marriage, right? The dating is we meet with the prospective buyer. We show them three homes. We put on the commission or showing agreement, the three homes that are that we're going to show. If you purchase that home that's on that list, then you owe us X amount of percent for that particular property, right? We go and show them. If you like the way I work with, you know what? Then we proceed to the marriage, and then we do the buyer brokerage agreement. So some people are going to that. Other people are going straight to the buyer brokerage agreement. But then, you know, the one thing I want to, you know, kind of tell people or maybe, you know, discuss is say, you know, we need to embrace and lean into these changes rather than trying to circumvent them. And I think too many, you know, realtors and even, you know, looking at title companies and such, trying to work with realtors as to trying to circumvent rules and things of that nature. You know, we're not going to be allowed to put on broker remarks, you know, any kind of compensation or, hey, for more information, look at this website or whatever it might be. Because when you're doing that, you're trying to circumvent. And we feel like you need to embrace, lean into it. And those that do that are going to be significantly more productive than than those that don't.
I would agree with that. Certainly, you know, when something like this comes out, people whose thought immediately goes to, okay, how can I get around this? How can I avoid complying? That doesn't sound like a particularly positive approach to, okay, this is something that I'm required to do. And so let's figure out how to make it a positive for the industry. So I agree with you 100%, David, that people shouldn't immediately be trying to get around this, because there is a successful path to continuing to do what it is that realtors do, which is help people buy and sell homes and other property too. But we're really talking about residential things here. So Evie
realtors can be resourceful. I'm sorry. They find ways around things. I'm encouraging realtors not to find a way and to actually, you know, be productive and embrace and lean into these changes.
Good. You know, I think that's a great philosophy to have, and one that hopefully most realtors will have. Let's go back to a comment that Evian made about what Florida Realtors is doing. So are they coming up with like suggested forms to be used by realtors, or are local boards coming up with their own forms?
So Florida Realty, so each local board makes its own decisions about whether it is going to offer forms or not, or if they're going to rely on Florida Realtors. So at Miami Realtors, most of the forms, the overwhelming number of forms that are available to our members are through Florida Realtors, are through Form Simplicity. That's where they can access everything. Now, what boards will do, you know, once the forms come out, that remains to be seen. But of course, Miami Realtors is definitely committed to making sure that our members have the tools that they need to continue doing what they do best, which is real estate, and so that they are successful in their business. And also an important update for those who do work with the forms, we found out that the forms that are coming out are going to be sort of rolled out in waves. So by mid-June, any day now, we're expecting the first wave of forms from Florida Realtors to be the compensation forms. So buyer, broker to broker compensation agreement, the seller to buyer's agent compensation agreement, and a modification to compensation agreement. Really important that those forms are coming out first for all the obvious reasons, right? So that folks can get compensated. I'm sure David's like, yes, absolutely. making sure that folks get compensated for their work. And then after that, the other forms that we've touched on, the buyer broker agreement, listing agreement, all of those forms are going to get overhauled is what we understand. And Melissa and David, I actually want to jump back, if you don't mind, to something that you mentioned, David, which is, you know, our members being really creative, which I love, right? Because that is one of their superpowers. And you, one of your superpowers, right, is navigating new situations. And so something that you all, you, the royal you, right, our realtor members raised to us, and we got clarification from NAR about, was websites, right? There's a lot of confusion about what folks can do with their websites, with IDX feeds, how that plays with the remarks or what you can put into the MLS. And absolutely right, can't put anything about compensation in the remarks. Can't say, hey, call me. There's a phone number, it's obvious, just call, right? You can't say, hey, we're gonna cooperate with brokers, come one, come all, can't do that, right? But what you can do, what NAR has clarified that you can do, is put a URL to your website in broker remarks, because it's 2024, we are not communicating by courier pigeons, right? To communicate what something is or isn't, right? There's phone numbers, which you can call or text. And so a website is really just another form of communication. And we're really glad that NAR has clarified that, because it takes, you know, an extra step to go and figure out what the website is, where a listing might be with more information, more videos, better staging, you know, more details about a property, right? It's not just about compensation. So again, our members are, that was a member suggestion, right? And so we appreciate them.
Well, kudos to them. David, do you have any comments about that?
No, she's absolutely right. You know, the only thing I would, again, you know, I still think it's a degree of circumvention, because what happens is an agent will go ahead and put a website, and then the first thing they'll say is that, you know, we're offering compensation on these six properties or whatever it might be. So, I think it is a very, close thing. I do know that NAR has come down with a few rules that we have changed, or a few suggestions, I should say, that we have changed and modified throughout. So I'm going to be looking at that. But, you know, we want to just all do business together. I kind of equate this to 2008 when the mortgage, when Dodd-Frank came out and all the loan officers ran for the hills. They went in the insurance business. Maybe they went in the real estate business. But, you know, they went everywhere else, right, because they felt like they could not do any more business because the changes were coming rapidly and they didn't know what they were going to do. And, HUD was now a closing disclosure and whatnot, right? So when we went through that, look at how many loan officers that stuck in since 2008. They made a little bit of money. I believe that that's going to be the same case with realtors going forward in being significantly more productive.
Yeah, that's great. Let's talk about one of my favorite documents, and that's the FAR Bar contract. I spend a lot of time talking with fund members about the FAR Bar contract and what's in there and what's not in there. Do you think it needs to be tweaked to address this new commission situation? And if so, what are you thinking would be advantageous for the FAR Bar contract to say?
David, do you want to go first?
I mean, I'll go quickly, and then obviously Evian will speak on the legal part. But, the Board of Attorney Review doesn't really work as quickly sometimes. So those forms aren't going to be out, Evian alluded to, in the first wave. Those are going to be quite a while. There certainly are going to be some changes that we're going to look for. One of those changes obviously is going to be the disclosure of compensation will probably be included somewhere in that FAR Bar contract and some of the other things. But, I'll lean on Evian for the legal terms.
Yeah, David's 1,000% right. That is one piece that definitely needs to be added, all of the compensation disclosure requirements, because it's not just for the buyer brokers that have to make these disclosures. There are disclosures that everyone's got to make, no matter which side of the transaction you're working. And there are specific requirements for sellers as well as for buyers. So it'll be really important to include those in any forms that roll out or even an independent compensation disclosure form. And as far as the other changes, I know Florida Realtors does a really, really thorough job in making sure that these forms make sense, right? That they are user friendly. It is a thankless job to make forms. And so we are immensely grateful that they are doing the heavy lifting on this, because it's not just a bunch of attorneys in the room. It is practitioners, which is immensely, immensely valuable, because they've got to be user friendly and they've got to be consumer friendly, right? And then on top of that, they have to be ironclad to make sure that folks get paid, right? It's not helpful to have a contract that or a form that has legal issues, right? And so we are looking forward to Florida Realtors' edits to those. And look, in the meantime, we are telling our members and training our members that there is nothing preventing you from taking the FAR Bar contract to your own attorney, right? This is something that we've taught them for years. You can take any of those forms, go to your attorney, have a conversation, a one-on-one conversation with your attorney. Don't go to a room of your competitors and have these conversations, because that would be an antitrust problem. But if you are going with your brokerage to your attorney and conveying to your attorney what your business goals are, your attorney will be able to help you navigate how to customize those forms. And there's nothing stopping our members from doing that now. And there's nothing stopping them from doing that once we do get these updated forms to make sure, because as David talked about earlier, there are so many different business models. And when you're talking about just a buyer broker agreement in and of itself, right, that can look a million different ways, all of which would comply with the NAR settlement. But again, it's going to depend on their independent and unilateral business decisions and models.
Because that's an interesting point that you just bring up that I think might be a question in a lot of people's minds. What are the acceptable ways for a buyer broker to be paid? Are there any restrictions on that in the NAR settlement? And if not, what are those options that people are talking about?
The big picture is that the compensation has to be on the buyer's side, right? The compensation, it has to be very clear what the buyer is expected to pay, if anything, right? It has to be very clear where that's coming from, right? It is still an acceptable business model for the seller side to compensate the buyer side, but that has to be clear. The compensation, if any, has to be, the magic words are objectively ascertainable, which David's like, oh man, I can see his face. Like, yeah, I feel the same, David. I wish there were better guidance on that, but what we've got is objectively ascertainable, right? And so, well, that's what we've got to work with. In terms of other compensation models, we've put together at Miami Realtors, we've put together several toolkits. One of those toolkits is a laundry list of different compensation models without endorsing any of them, right? On both the seller and buyer side, because part of this is going to be navigating how to do business now, what makes sense for your business, what kind of models make sense, what kind of business models, you know, how you get compensated. You're going to have to figure that out for your businesses. And part of what we've put together is a toolkit for our members to start thinking about what those might be. And all of those are on miamirealtors.com/facts. And everybody listening is, those are publicly available. So everybody listening in, please do use those.
David, your comments, how are you approaching the different ways that you can be compensated if you're being acting as a buyer broker?
Yeah, I mean, and you know, Evian really kind of elaborated on most of it. But, you know, one of the key components of the written agreement or buyer brokerage agreement is that you can't be compensated more than what the seller is offering. So you got to be very careful, you know, and let's talk about a little bit about the objective of what this settlement really was doing. This, the objective, and whether we agree with it or not agree with it, doesn't matter. But the objective was to make it more transparent to the consumer, regardless of whether you think it is more or less transparent. That was the objective. And so the objective was that when a buyer's agent or buyer broker goes to a buyer, the buyer really knows how much they're going to be compensated, that buyer broker. And so whether they get it from the seller, a combination of the seller and the buyer, or they get it, you know, through all different, you know, avenues, you know, it's going to be that the buyer pays X amount of percent to the buyer broker, whether they get it from the seller or not, right? So when we look at that, if the seller's offering more, if the seller's offering Y percent instead of X percent, and it's more than X percent, then you would have to go back to the buyer and either negotiate whatever X percent, you know, Y percent is over the X percent and go over it with that buyer and get the buyer to agree to modify that buyer brokerage agreement, or the buyer broker cannot be paid Y percent. They could only be paid X percent. And I know I'm talking X and Ys, but, you know, we've all been trained now, you know, to stay away from antitrust. And I certainly don't want any more liability on anything. So we'll talk
good
about
training.
X and Ys. Yeah, and that brings me back to my algebra days, so it's perfect.
And you know, one of the unique pieces of the buyer broker agreement that we're going to be dealing with in South Florida, I think I can speak for all of South Florida in that we're unique in a lot of ways. And one of those ways is that we have a lot of developer-owned inventory, whether that's new construction or something else. We've got a lot of developer-owned inventory. And our members have been telling us, look, it is going to be, if we're working with buyers, it is a royal, you know, pill to go and have to amend, because the solution to what David was saying is that the solution is you're going to have to get an amendment to your contract, which, you know, I am an attorney. That is not my favorite thing to do, right? Melissa, you probably agree. And so, you know, amending contracts is no fun, especially when you're in the middle of trying to get a transaction done. And one of the solutions that we've proposed is having in your buyer broker agreement, having different compensation amounts for different types of inventory. So whether it's, you know, single family home, maybe it's a townhome, I don't know, maybe you're working with somebody on commercial deals as well, right? So maybe that will look very different, but same thing, have a checkbox for the developer owned inventory. That way you're not having to go back in the middle of, you know, working with your customer and having an awkward conversation about, hey, you know, we really need to amend this because I'd like to get paid more. That conversation is unnecessary.
Well, what I really hear you saying is that you all don't want to have six different versions of the buyer broker agreement. You want to have one buyer broker representation agreement that might have alternatives that could have check boxes or alternatives. If this, then this.
I mean, there's going to be proprietary, you know, certainly brokerage. Yeah. Buyer brokerage agreements that the broker requires from their agents. And, you know, we'll see some of it. We'll have probably most of the same key terms that a standard buyer brokerage agreement may have. You know, so it's not going to be like, you know, because right now most people, I would say overwhelming majority in South Florida, use the FAR bar contract. Yeah. You know, some of them use the FAR contract, but most of them use the FAR bar contract. And that FAR bar contract, you don't normally have a buyer going to their attorney or a seller going to their attorney and having a contract drawn up, because, you know, most of the key terms are already in it. I think you're going to have a little bit more variation with the buyer brokerage agreements. Some people have talked about bilateral and unilateral cancellations. A lot of the buyer brokerage agreements have unilateral cancellations from the buyer. They can cancel basically for any reason with notice. And, you know, some people say, no, I don't want that. I want it to be like a listing agreement. And, you know, it says, hey, they may cancel or whatever it might be. So you're going to see some variations.
So I want to ask one question and get some feedback from both of you before we call on Jada. Share any questions that he has, but what can fund members do? What can real estate attorneys do to help your people in this situation? What are some specific ways in which they could play a role to help realtors work their way through these changes? David, what do you think?
I would say get a therapist license. That's the first part. But if you're not doing that, you got to be there first. You got to support your, you know, your agents and realtors, because, you know, the realtors, first of all, no one likes change, right? But realtors sometimes don't embrace change as quickly as they should. And you got to be there. You got to specifically, you know, I think you can help them, you know, navigate some of the buyer brokerage agreements, potentially having, you know, some workshops in your title office or whatnot. You know, those workshops and role model, you know, those role plays would be great. A lot of people are clamoring for that, whether their brokerage is doing that or not. That is a way to really bring in, you know, some value to your realtors and potentially get more business because of it.
Evian, what do you think are some specific things that real estate lawyers could do to help?
Yeah, ditto on all of that. And also, one of the tools that we put together for our members is called the Antitrust Audit Checklist. Again, it's on our website, miamirealtors.com/facts. We are telling our members, print this out, take it with you to your attorney, and go through it. Go through your policies, go through your contracts, go through your training manuals, and sit down with your attorney to ensure that all of these pieces are in compliance with antitrust laws. I don't care if you're doing commercial work. I don't care if you're doing residential. I don't care if you're doing leasing, mostly, you know, renting out properties. Antitrust law is antitrust law. It applies to all areas of business, really. We saw the yacht brokers have been sued recently. Hermé was sued recently over the Birkin bag situation. So, you know, everyone in real estate needs to know that no matter what kind of real estate you're practicing, that antitrust laws apply. Take this checklist, go to your attorneys, sit down with them and have a conversation about all the pieces in it. And the reason that we flagged all of these different policies and training manuals and such that need to be reviewed is because that's what came out as evidence in these trials, in this trial in Missouri, right? And so if you know, if we now know that this is the evidence that was wielded against our members, right, then that's what we need to be looking at now and sit down. And I know it is not popular to say, you know, go sit down with your attorney. Nobody wants to go sit down with your attorney, right? Like that is, you know, folks would rather go to the dentist. You know, Melissa.
Wait a minute.
We're biased, right? And so we have the good fortune of working together in this industry, right? But you know, look, I know it's a big ask and I know that change is hard, but this is really, really critical. And this is what attorneys can be doing now to really help our members.
Excellent. Jay, you got any really great questions for us to pose to David and Evian?
Well, they're all great, Melissa, of course. But just all thoughtful, but let me just grab a couple for you here. One question is, would a general provision in a buyer broker agreement that accounts for seller paying more be sufficient? For example, buyer broker agree that buyer's broker is entitled to 3% compensation.
Jay, I am so sorry. We cannot have questions that deal with numbers or percentages because that is an antitrust policy violation on our end. And
that's
David, I'm going to speak for you, David.
That's an answer in itself.
Got me.
Pick another question.
Well, speaking of which, would Evian, be willing to share her antitrust guidelines with fund members?
Yes, it's on miamirealtors.com/facts. And all of our resources are there. You don't have to have a login or anything like that to download.
Thanks.
Do you want one more, Melissa, or are we wrapping up?
Yeah, one more.
All right. I think this one maybe might be illuminating. How about the contractual liability a broker now faces with his associates signing buyer's agreements? As a broker, this is my main concern.
David.
Yeah, is that legal advice, Evian?
Well, I'll just speak on behalf as a broker. We do that with listing agreements, right? The broker doesn't sign the listing agreements, gives authorized signer to the agent. So your buyer brokerage agreements, I haven't seen the most recent, it hasn't come out yet, the buyer brokerage agreement from Florida Realtors, but, it's going to say most likely say an authorized signer. So, is there liability? Sure, there is liability, but, you have liability by agents, working underneath you, going out there every day with, working with the public. So I don't think this is any, increased liability, by these changes. It's really kind of the same thing as if you bring in a buyer into the car because you have some degree of, agency relationship, even if it is a transaction brokerage relationship.
Any other comments to that, Evian?
Completely agree. And that's one of those issues that as a broker, right, it depends on the size of your brokerage, the structure of your brokerage. Those are all conversations that you want to have, with your management team as well as your attorneys to determine what kind of signing authority that all lives in your training manuals, your onboarding procedures, all of that, your independent contractor agreements. So you have to take a close look at that. And Melissa, going back, so I want to go back to the initial part of the first question before we gave the antitrust buzzer of death. This is a question we're getting a lot. What happens if I, as a buyer's agent or buyer's broker, have the opportunity to get paid more? The guidance that we have received from NAR is, and in the language of the settlement agreement, is that if you are going to get paid more, you can't do that. It needs to be objectively ascertainable. So having, a cutoff mark from X and then saying, whatever else after that, you have to make sure that whatever it is that you are doing is, again, objectively ascertainable. And I know that's a really, it's a tough question. It's a non, sort of a non-answer to the answer to the question, but that is the best guidance that we have for now. And we are hoping that as this unfolds some more, that we are going to get some better guidance on that, and especially in the forms.
And we also were talking about ranges, right? If, you know, a minimum of this and max of this, you know, that was also NAR's guidance came back. Originally they said yes, and now they've come back and said no.
Yeah.
So, you know, you know, one of the things we have to realize, and certainly as many of you on this call are attorneys, or maybe all of you are attorneys, you know, one of the things you have to realize is that, you know, you don't really want to ask the other side if you can do this or do that. So a lot of this stuff has been vague and ambiguous based on pretty much on purpose, because, you know, they don't want to say, hey, can we do this, you know, to the plaintiffs? Can we do that? Because the answer is always going to be no. So, you know, so they're kind of coming up and, you know, with guidance throughout, you know, depending on how things are progressing.
Well, unfortunately, I think we need to wrap this up because I do promise people that it's only about 30 minutes and we've reached that mark. And I feel like we have barely touched the surface on this. I mean, you guys have talked nonstop for over 30 minutes, and I just feel like we have barely opened the door. So I want my fund members to know, and everybody that's listening out there to know, that this isn't the only webinar we're going to do on the NAR settlement, because forms are going to start coming out very shortly, and we're going to want to talk about those forms and those documents. And so perhaps David and Evian would be willing to come back and, you know, give us an update in a month or two as to what is going on. But I do want to thank David and Evian for their time involved in this, because they're both very busy right now and they agreed to take the time to talk with me today. I want to thank everybody that attended the webinar. And as always, thank you for your support of the fund.